Hello and welcome to our call for the month. Let's see, this is, what month are we in? May. So hello and welcome to the Healing Power of Brassicas. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm very excited to be here to present this to you and to get you excited about this amazing group of foods. They're foods that, I don't know, they get a bad rap. There's a lot of myths about them. We're going to try to dispel some of those myths, but they are so chock full of nutrition and so chock full of phytochemicals that support and protect your body that I really think we all need to pay attention to them and start including them on a regular basis. So we're just going to get started with a little of my philosophy, which you've heard me talk about all the time, but Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And what this means is we don't have to go to the pharmacy. We don't have to go to the doctor for every ailment and ache and pain and say, what pill can I take? We actually can look at the food. And I love the ancient Ayurvedic proverb that says, when the food is correct, medicine is of no need. When the food is incorrect, medicine is of no use. So I'm going to share with you today about the healing powers of brassicas. But I want to make sure that you're aware that everything I talk about is in the spirit of education. It's not medical advice. And even though we may talk about the connection and the research behind the way that brassicas interact in the body and the way they support different organs and gland systems and some of the research that's related to particular disease, this is not intended to replace a one-on-one consultation relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. And it's not medical advice. So if you find something really exciting in here, before you go jumping and getting off medication and shifting things around, just make sure that you consult with your practitioner. All that said, I want to jump right in. So when Hippocrates said, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food, there's little doubt in my mind that he was referring to the foods from the brassica family. This is from Rebecca Katz, who's the author of a book called Brassicas. It's a beautiful book with lots of glorious pictures, recipes, research, and anecdotes. So if you want to learn more, it's an awesome book. You can find it on Amazon. So what do I want to cover in this presentation? I want to make sure that you understand what the foods are that's part of the brassica family, that you recognize them, that you recognize their amazing health benefits. I want to also talk a little bit about the dark side of brassicas and some of the bad reputation they've gotten and some of the situations in which you may have to be just a little cautious about how much you consume. And then I want to talk about how do you best incorporate these amazing foods into your daily life. I incorporate them probably three meals a day. If I eat three meals a day, and if I only eat two, I incorporate them into both meals. When I make my smoothies in the morning, I put broccoli sprouts in there. When I have stir fries or steamed vegetables, I always include at least one or two brassicas. Whenever I do blended soups or I make nut pâtés, I always include foods from the brassica family. So easy to include, and we'll talk about how you can make them more a part of your life. So we'll meet the brassicas. You'll also call them the crucifers, cruciferous vegetables. You may see it stated in both ways. And this is a list. It's a long list, and there's some things you might not have even realized are part of the brassica family. We all know that broccoli and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, but what about arugula, bok choy? What about cabbage and, well, cauliflower we know? Chinese cabbage, which is a different shape of cabbage, collard greens, daikon radish that doesn't look like the rest of these with this leafy stuff, but they're white and their leaves are actually very good to eat as well. Even horseradish, kale, kohlrabi, land cress, mustard greens, radishes of all sorts, not just the daikon, but black radishes, red radishes, all sorts of radishes. Rutabaga, that's more of a little bit more starchy, that's part of it. So are turnips. Shepherd's purse, which is a wild edible that doesn't grow everywhere, but most of us don't eat it on a regular basis either. And watercress. So this is a list of the brassica family. So you're welcome to take this chart, and if as you're trying to include more of these into your life, that you refer to it and say, hey, I've gotten this. honestly, I think you need to get at least 2 cups of brassicas every day, or most days. Up to 4 would be even more advantageous. When I make a smoothie, I'm always putting several cups, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 cups even of greens in my smoothie. And usually there's something from the brassica family. Usually I do kale or arugula, broccoli sprouts. I usually don't do cabbage in my smoothies, but I sometimes do daikon radish. So there's a lot of ways to incorporate these into your diet. So there's a picture. I have those good old broccoli sprouts up at the top because they're really easy to incorporate. Even if you can't find them in those cool little packages, they're expensive to find in those cool little packages, and they're not available year-round in a lot of places. So you can sprout your own, and they're very easy. You take the seeds, which you see off to the right side, and you put them in a bowl or a mason jar, and you allow them to sit overnight and plump up. You rinse them off. You turn the jar at an angle, and you hang it in your dish drain. And you watch them grow. You rinse it once or twice a day, depending on where you live. If you live in Houston in the summer, you rinse them 3 times a day. If you live in a dry climate, you can do it less often because they're less likely to mold and rot. And then those are the rest of them. I mean, those little seeds are the powerhouses. And there's a lot of ways that you can find them. Microgreens is another way to find them. Very easy to toss into salads and into smoothies and get your share. So why do we want to include these? Why are they so beneficial? Well, number one, they've been attributed to hormone balance. They help to convert between estrogens, the estrogens that the body makes, and then these what's called metabolites of estrogen that the body converts to get rid of the used up estrogen. Some of them are dangerous, like the 4-hydroxy, for those of you who know, and some of them are more protective, like the 2-hydroxy. And the brassicas help us to convert between those estrogen metabolites in such a way as to decrease the carcinogenic 4s and increase the protective 2s. So really good things. Detoxification. If we look at the stages in our liver and how it detoxifies the environment, we learn that brassica vegetables actually help to upregulate the phase 2 detoxification pathways in the liver, so it makes it much easier for our bodies to eliminate toxins. They're nutritional powerhouses. On average, there's over 25% of your daily allotment or need for protein in 3 cups. Wow, that's pretty good. So if we do 3 cups and we get 25% of our protein, wow, that's a lot. Now if we do 5 or 6 cups, we're getting close to 50%. And that's without eating concentrated protein sources. Some of them are higher protein than others. The sprouts tend to be higher percentage protein. Broccoli tends to be in the neighborhood of 42 to 48% protein. They're low in calories, which everyone wants to hear if you're watching your weight, right? So the 200 calories of steamed broccoli will provide you with 20 grams of protein. That's phenomenal, okay? That's phenomenal. And that's a lot of broccoli, right? That's a lot of broccoli. So you can eat these in unlimited capacity without exceeding your caloric intake for the day. Really hard to do that. And they're high in fiber, so they feed the good colonic bacteria, and they help to brush the toxins and all through your system. They tend to be anti-inflammatory. They contain particular phytochemicals that help the body to decrease inflammation. And we know that inflammation is part of the disease process, and it actually anything that ends in itis, but almost all diseases are a result of inflammation, and all pain syndromes are a result of inflammation. They're antioxidant, loaded with antioxidants. So we know that antioxidants are needed to scavenge the free radicals that are produced by metabolic processes, day-to-day living, environmental toxins and exposures, poor quality fats, fats that have been exposed to heat, air, and light, and then used, create oxidative byproducts. And broccoli and the other friends in its family contain a lot of nutrients to help break that down. And then they're cardioprotective and cancer protective. There are umpteen studies. If you were to go to the medical research and look up brassicas and the relationship with cancer, there are studies that show that it's protective with breast cancer for sure, and part of that is because of the effects it has on the estrogens. Prostate cancer, again, it's a hormonal cancer, colon cancer, and there's others. So look up broccoli sprouts in particular and their cancer protective effects. And they're cardioprotective. They help to raise up the good cholesterol, the HDLs, and lower the LDLs and increase the body's ability to eliminate the bad cholesterol, the used up and the oxidized fat. So very protective and very beneficial. Here's a few studies that were done on cancers and cruciferous vegetables. So the left column contains the cancer type. Then it contains which cruciferous vegetables or how many different cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cabbage, and kale. So it separates them out. So if you look at all cancers, there are 590 studies total that look at all the cruciferous vegetables, 551 that mention broccoli, 489 that specifically target cabbage, and 530 that do kale. So the all cruciferous vegetables means it just said cruciferous vegetables as a whole. So you can see how amazing these studies are. That's in the published medical research. Bladder cancer, less studies, but still significant. Breast cancers, less but significant, right? So we add all these up, and it's a tremendous help and a boon for somebody to protect themselves, because we always want to go for protection first, not treatment. And then also after people have been diagnosed, these tend to be protective. So again, work with your doctor if you have cancer, and the act of adding a bunch of cruciferous vegetables on a regular basis is it's very low risk, if any risk. So let's talk a little bit about the science. I know some of you are geeky like me and you like to understand how these things work. These are particular chemicals in the cruciferous vegetables called glucosinolates. And there are several different types of glucosinolates. And these glucosinolates then convert downstream into protective, or, you know, some of them don't have much in the way of research. We're not going to spend a whole time talking about each of these and how they work, but these are some of them if you see them. Glucosinolates, erucin, they're really hard to say. The glucobrassica napin has a lot to do with the levels of sulforaphane. I can't say these. I'm just going to leave it at that. These are glucosinolates, and these have been studied and found to then convert inside the body to particular protective effects. And the one that gets the most press is this one called sulforaphane. Sulforaphane has been found to improve phase 2 liver detoxification, including glutathione as transferase, which increases the level of glutathione. It enhances tumor suppression proteins, which is awesome. It can protect against skin cancer by protecting against the UV radiation damage. It can protect the heart by decreasing inflammation, and it's been shown to decrease the level of atherosclerosis. It inhibits an enzyme called histone deacetylase. So these are specific studies and health benefits of sulforaphane, and you've probably heard of sulforaphane. People are isolating sulforaphane and taking it as supplements, but it's an active constituent in the body when we eat cruciferous vegetables. They're derived from the glucosinolates. Remember I said the glucosinolates convert to, so they convert these isothiocyanates by chewing, and chewing increases the activity of this enzyme called myrosinase. Myrosinase is part of the broccoli, the cauliflower, the cabbage, the brassica families. Isothiocyanates have gotten a bad rap. They've been called the goitrogens because they can inhibit. And when eaten raw, these isothiocyanates, that they cannot inhibit the activity of the thyroid, but they have to be in huge amounts. So a lot of people are telling you only eat cooked cruciferous. And they may be true in somebody with severe thyroid problems, with detoxification issues, and a whole bunch of other issues that cause the isothiocyanates not to be converted into sulforaphane. But in reality, we need to have these in order to be protecting us. Okay, so as a bottom line, there's this enzyme called myrosinase. Myrosinase is heat sensitive. So myrosinase will not work if we heat up the food, right? So when we heat up the food, we kill it, we decrease the creation of sulforaphane. Now, here's the thing. What you can do is you can, if you're going to eat your broccoli cooked up, you chop up your broccoli and let it sit for half an hour, 45 minutes. The myrosinase actually works to create sulforaphane while it's sitting. The sulforaphane is not heat sensitive. So once you've created the sulforaphane, your body can then eat it. You then can heat them and you'll have the sulforaphane and it's active. But if you heat it first without chopping or chewing, right? Food process it. The chewing is what activates the myrosinase. But if you heat it before you do that, the myrosinase is gone. So even though you're chewing the steamed broccoli, you won't have access to it. So just a little tip for helping you, especially if you've got some gut issues and you find that raw cruciferous are hard to digest. I find raw cruciferous not as appealing in some of them, like broccoli, cauliflower. I really like them in lightly steamed or stir-fried. And so you chop them up, you let them sit for a while. Okay, so like making a broccoli slaw. It's really good because you're grinding it down. And if that still doesn't sit right for you, then you slightly heat it. So broccoli sprouts are the most concentrated source of sulforaphane. They've been studied up the wazoo. And in addition to them being protective with cancers, they can actually inhibit H. pylori growth. So that's a cool thing. H. pylori is that bacteria that can live in the stomach and lead to stomach ulcers. So how does this work? Okay, so I'm just going to summarize this. I just went through it. Glucosinolates, myrosinase is needed to break them down into these other constituents. So glucoraphanin is what converts into sulforaphane. Glucobrassicin gets converted into indole-3-carbinol, which gets then converted into diindolemethane. You will see on the market specific supplements called indole-3-carbinol, I3C, and DIM. And it's used a lot to help the body to make these safer estrogens. So in people who have estrogen dominance and they're dominant in the lack of protective, the harmful estrogens, then they take these. But you don't need to take them if you eat enough cruciferous vegetables and you make enough sulforaphane. Okay, so it's just showing you how to do this with food. They actually also promote protective estrogen receptors. There's estrogen receptor alpha, estrogen receptor beta. Estrogen receptor beta is actually more protective, and estrogen receptor alpha is what's called proliferative. So if you have a predominance of estrogen receptor alpha, then you're going to be at higher risk for breast cancer, right? So it's really nice that the brassicas actually protect your breasts. Yay. Very cool, right? Let me get rid of that little thingy. All right, so here's some references. You have these in your charts that I gave you. If you have just joined us, if you look at the top, you can click and it'll say slides on brassicas. You can download them. They'll also be in the membership site when this gets posted. All right, but there's some references that talk about how this stuff works if you want to dig into the science and go deeper. So the foods that contain sulforaphane, again, are the cruciferous vegetables. We've got those listed again. The effects of cooking on sulforaphane. Cooking reduces the negative effects of the isothiocyanates, but it also decreases the protective activity of the sulforaphane. So you've got to decide for yourself what balance you can choose. And like I said before, the protective effect of the sulforaphane can be increased by chopping and then cooking. So glucosinolates and their anti-cancer isothiocyanates. Okay, so this is a geeky chart. Again, I think I first put this chart together for teaching our practitioners, but I know some of you are practitioners, so you find this helpful. It tells you which of the cruciferous vegetables and then which of the glucosinolates they contain and then which of the derived isothiocyanates they contain. So you see there we have the glucoraphanin with the sulforaphane, the glucobrassicin with the indole-3-carbinol, another one called synigrin, which creates this other isothiocyanate, and then these others that, you know, haven't been as much studied, but they're certainly studied. So diindole methane, which we said gets converted from that glucobrasin, and you can also take it separately, but it's actually been shown to inhibit cancer growth in experimental animals. It's considered a safe form. And some scientists believe that you're better off with indole-3-carbinol and let it convert to iindole methane. There's a lot of controversy out in the literature with that. So how does it affect the thyroid? So the glucosinolates are precursors to the isothiocyanates. Myrosinase, like I said, transforms into the sulforaphane, the isothiocyanates. But here's the thing. The isothiocyanates hurt the thyroid in that they bind to iodine, or potentially hurt it. That's the mechanism. They basically hold it hostage in the bloodstream so it can't get into the thyroid. So here's, insensitive people, this is a problem. But here's the thing. It's usually a problem eating raw cruciferous in excess if you've got an iodine deficiency, which quite frankly is common in our society because the iodine is really hard to absorb. The soils inland are stripped of it. You've got to buy crops that are grown right by the sea. So the iodine in land vegetables is practically nil, if not nil. So you need to be eating sea vegetables. So here's what I tell people who are concerned about the negative effects of raw brassicas on the thyroid. First of all, usually not a problem unless you have a genetic tendency to have thyroid issues. You have thyroid issues as a result of exposures or you know, autoimmunity and all the stressors that's caused by. And you're deficient in iodine. So generally speaking, iodine sufficiency protects people from the negative effects. That said, everybody's a little different. So if you find that your thyroid condition gets worse when you eat raw cruciferous vegetables, then I would say go ahead and steam them. So here's some studies. There have been studies that are done with rats, and they're injected with isolated isothiocyanates. So this is not, they're not fed broccoli. They're injected with the isolated isothiocyanates. The large quantities that they injected actually showed an inhibition of thyroid function. But the equivalent of what they fed them in isothiocyanate, you'd have to be eating like 10 pounds a day of cruciferous vegetables. And I don't know about you, but I eat a lot of cruciferous vegetables. I don't think I've ever eaten 10 pounds in a day. Okay, so yes, there are sensitive people. Yes, there are a couple of cases. There was a case where some woman was eating like pounds and pounds and pounds a day of cruciferous vegetables, and she developed a goiter as a result. Okay, so here's the thing with the rats, though. When they were given iodine along with the isothiocyanates, the results were reversed. So again, if they were given an isolated compound, even then, in very large quantities, even then when they were given iodine, it was reversed. So the takeaway from this is for us is if you're going to eat raw cruciferous, have kelp with it. Have a seaweed salad with it. I use powdered kelp and I sprinkle it in my smoothies. I sprinkle it on my veggies, on my salads. I use it in making salad dressing. And that helps you to get enough iodine in your diet. Okay. We don't want to overdo that either because too much iodine can affect the thyroid negatively as well. Right. So sea vegetables, like I just said, you can add them to smoothies, salads, juices, add them when you're having raw cruciferous. Sometimes I'll make a salad and I'll get arame, my favorite. I take arame, which looks like spaghetti. I soak it, rinse it off. I save the soak water because it's loaded with nutrition. And then I'll shred, say, carrots and cabbage and other cruciferous, even broccoli. Right, the stems of the broccoli make a really nice slaw. So it's like making a slaw, and then I'll put some kelp on it. I might put a little bit of toasted sesame oil on it. I'll definitely put some ginger and turmeric. And this salad is so amazingly nutrient dense, and it's supplying your raw cruciferous vegetables with your iodine, plenty of sulforaphane, and it's very, very protective. So we talked about how the chewing, blending, and juicing will release the myrosinase. So for people who say, oh, well, you have to drink your smoothie right away, I say when you drink your smoothie right away, you're not giving the myrcinase chance to work. So even if you wait a half an hour, personally, we blend up, we make 3 days worth of smoothies and keep them in the fridge. We put lots of lemon, lots of turmeric, lots of ginger to preserve them. And so that's actually a time saver, number one, but it's also a really good way to activate the myrcinase. Okay? Good digestion and liver detoxification can negate a serious problem. Okay, so whenever somebody's found to have low detoxification or problems with a leaky gut, they have been found to have more of a problem with the isothiocyanates not being utilized the way they're supposed to be. Okay, what else? There's some references. Again, you can do some research. There's a lot of other references. I have a stack about 4 inches tall of studies that I found relating to this, and my conclusion after doing all that is most people do not have to be concerned about raw cruciferous unless you're eating many pounds a day and you're iodine deficient and, you know, liver and gut not working well. So here's how I like to do it. Okay, so with raw, we'll do it in smoothies or juices, and I always add some iodine-containing sea vegetables. I like to just keep a little thing of ground-up kelp, sprinkle it on. Lightly steamed. Fermented is great. Fermented will activate even more digestibility in them. So if you have trouble with, say, raw cabbage, fermented might be good. Now, some people have problems with histamine and they're healing their gut. Usually it's a gut issue and they have problem with the fermented. So you have to really just take my suggestions and play around with them and find what works best for you. We're all biochemically unique. Blended, juiced. I do blended as soups and as smoothies. I've done blended where I'll blend up the vegetables and make kind of a smoothie, but not fruited smoothie, and then lightly warm it, you know, put it in a bowl and put it over a steamer basket. You can lightly steam the vegetables and put it in the blender with the water. This is one of my favorite ways to do it. And then blend them up and add Thai seasoning and some coconut and make a Thai soup, or add some avocado and some Mexican seasoning and make a Mexican soup. There's all sorts of ways to get plenty of these. When I eat them, I literally will take a whole head of cauliflower, not a little bit of cauliflower. A whole head of cauliflower to me is a meal, right? And I add, you know, a tahini dressing to it, or I blend it up and make it a mashed potatoes. But they're significant quantities. It's not the little two stalks of broccoli on the plate that they serve in most restaurants. So I recommend that you rotate. And that's true of any greens and any foods. We rotate. You don't eat the same thing over and over. Number one, you're just giving your body just a certain subset of nutrition, not the full gamut of nutrition, right? So you want to vary so you get a variety of nutrients, but also you can become sensitive. Every single food, plant food, animal food, every single food has some sort of toxic component. It's the plant's way to protect against a predator eating too much of it. So the animals are really smart. They're still in touch with their nature, and they eat a little bit and they go, oh, that's enough for me, and they move to the next plant. We as humans have lost touch with our intuitive eating capabilities, and we can overdo it. So variety is the key. And I like 3 to 4 cups of brassicas a day, minimally, right? You can do more, but don't do 20 pounds in a day if they're raw. Oxalates are a particular chemical constituent we hear a lot about. We hear about people who respond to oxalates. Generally, people have trouble with oxalates if they have a leaky gut. Because the problem with oxalates is that it can bind calcium. But if you take a food like spinach, which has the highest amount of oxalates, spinach, rhubarb, and chard, and you eat it, those foods have tons of calcium, especially spinach and chard, tons of calcium. The net calcium effect of the oxalates binding the calcium and taking it out is that you still get a lot of calcium, right? But I don't eat spinach on a regular basis because I'd rather eat other foods that are lower in oxalates so I don't lose a lot of my calcium and other minerals. So when there's a problem with oxalates, when there's a problem with the leaky gut, the oxalates actually don't go get excreted, they get absorbed into the bloodstream. And high levels of oxalates can be problematic for the kidneys. It can cause the formation of kidney stones. it's associated with a condition called vulvodynia, where this is pain in the vulva region in women, and it's not really explained by much else. It can be caused by oxalate crystals forming. So what we want to do is rotate. Again, we don't want to eat spinach every day. A lot of people do that and they go, I can't eat smoothies because I don't feel good. So they're eating too much spinach because that's all they're eating because it's mild. Vary your vegetables, rotate your crucifers, and the ones, look up a chart to see which ones are lower in oxalates if you suspect that you have a problem. Seriously, foods are foods are foods, right? They're coming from nature. If we eat them in the right way and our body's in balance, we should be able to eat reasonable amounts of all these foods, these great vegetables loaded with antioxidants on a regular basis. So if you're having trouble with a particular food constituent, it's not the food's fault. It's your body is unable to process it properly. And then it means working on the digestion, elimination, working on your antioxidant status, etc. And what else do we have? So this is an excellent article about should we eat them. It kind of talks about what I just did, but maybe in a little bit more detail. For the sensitive people, it can cause painful and inflamed joints. It may feel like there's arthritis or fibromyalgia. There may be urinary burning or bowel movements that burn because these oxalates get in there. Vulvodynia, which we just talked about. Some people, depression. I know someone I worked with, and she was a super sensitive to oxalates. Very tiny, tiny amounts set her off. And it took us a while to figure it out. So we had to work on her leaky gut. We had to work on her liver detoxification. And little by little, she was able to eat a little bit more. I mean, I remember her writing to me and saying, hey, I just ate like 2 teaspoons or 2 tablespoons of spinach. Now, for most people, that's nothing. But for her, it was a really big progress piece. More about oxalate sensitivity. I know a lot of people are interested, so I stuck these in. I had these slides. Kidney stones, problematic, developmental disorders. So some kids like having trouble with developmental, they have trouble with autism, finding oxalate sensitivity is important. Now we know that a lot of kids have leaky guts and have gut inflammation. Some of them are born that way because mom was out of balance and didn't provide good flora. Some of them are fed cow's milk or formulas or put on antibiotics. So there's a lot of reasons that I think kids and people in general develop this sensitivity. Mercury, you know, other things like that can be problematic. Okay. This is a cool fact. Concentration of oxalates in spinach is the lowest in the autumn. So some people can eat spinach in autumn maybe and not other times of year. That's why. And there's a little article about that. So let's talk about a couple of other constituents in there. We talked about the quote unquote goitrogens. We talked about the oxalates. Let's talk a little bit about sulfur. Sulfur is super, super important. It's super important in our detox pathways. A lot of people take extra sulfur to improve their detox. They'll take methyl sulfuramethane or something like that. I don't remember the exact, but MSM basically. It's a sulfur and methyl groups. Super important. And a lot of people just, everything's fine. But do you ever notice that some people say, well, or maybe you, I don't tolerate onions and garlic. They're too, you know, high in sulfur. They may not even know that, but that's the reason. And it has to do with their pathways being blocked. That could be a genetic tendency that they don't have the ability to handle it. It could be nutrient insufficiency that they don't have all the nutrients to take them through that. So if you have a problem with the sulfur, then you're going to, you know, play with your cruciferous vegetables because they have a fair amount of sulfur, and you're going to just find the right dose for you and the right ones. The onions and garlic actually have the higher concentration of sulfur than the brassicas. So if you have trouble with the onions and garlic, you may have to watch the amount of brassicas you eat. But also while you're doing that, you need to be working on your nutrients. You need to be working on your antioxidants, possibly glutathione, cysteine, and some of those other things, and molybdenum, B6, that are involved in the sulfur pathways. Okay? So we don't have time to go into all, you know, the details on that. There's a whole biochemistry related to it, and there's a whole bunch of genetics related to it. If you tend to have a lot of brain fog, you know, you might have a sulfur sensitivity. So you want to find out, like if you say, well, I can't tolerate brassicas. Well, maybe you can't tolerate large amounts of brassicas. Maybe you can't tolerate specific types of. So it's really a matter of finding that balance, like what's the right thing for you. Some people will eliminate them all for, you know, a few days, and then small amounts, and gradually increase it. You want to get a lot of them, as much as you can tolerate. And I made the analogy here to gluten-free. Like with gluten-free, even a tiny amount is going to set you off if you're sensitive. You can't go sulfur-free, because the only way you do that is if you're on a perpetual water fast. So what you want to do is look to see where your tolerance level lies, and then find out what other nutrients can support it. So some people have trouble with handling sulfur. Put them on a little bit of B6 and molybdenum, a mineral, a micro mineral, and that can help it as well. Okay, so all of this stuff is very supportive. Helping to support methylation, so the homocysteine that they produce doesn't get allowed to convert downstream to too much sulfur, and making sure that the methylation is working so it gets, the methyl groups are used to create SAMe. You can test strips. There's a lot of controversy over that, but you can look at that. That's a link to Amazon. We just shortened it because you know how Amazon links are. They're huge. But the sulfur strips, I've bought them and I've played around with them, but I've never really done a whole, you know, extensive study on them to see if we can figure it out. But if you have a tendency to have problems with it, you might be able to correlate the amount you eat with the amount that comes out, and you may be able to correlate when you feel better. You might feel better at a certain amount that's being excreted, and then you can learn what your tolerance is of the different vegetables. So in summary, we are really, we're blessed to have access to this amazing group of vegetables called the brassicas, the cruciferous vegetables. We want to be able to incorporate as much of this into our diet as our body allows. And know that anytime you're making shifts, you may have to go really slowly to let your body adjust. Some people say that too much of the brassicas give them gas. Well, if that's the case, it's probably because your gut flora is out of balance. So working on the gut flora, working on eating fermented foods, probiotic foods. I mean, there's a lot to this. I'm trying to oversimplify it here. There's a lot to this. And when we work with people one-on-one and we look at all their tests, we help them to determine the right amount of these foods based on their symptomatology and also based on test results. So they're amazingly loaded, loaded, loaded with nutrients and cancer protective nutrients and isosulforaphane and the antioxidants that are in there. They're an anti-inflammatory. So if you're suffering from any kind of joint pain, pain condition, itis of any kind, you know, reflux, anything like that, they can be very helpful. The protective of the heart and the hormones. Remember, we talked about how with the estrogens, they will actually keep you in the safe zone with estrogen. So that's the end of my presentation today. I hope this was informative and helpful. And we're going to open it up for questions. I'll start a new one. I'll start a new recording for questions. So let's see. Let me pull you guys over here. Whoops, that's not it. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to take this one. There we go. All right. So let me go to see who's here. Let me go to the chat. Oh, not a lot of activity. Methyl sulforamethane. Yeah, I was close. I'm not bad. I'm not good at remembering specific. I like when I, once I get the abbreviations down, I got them. Yeah, so I think JS, it's a powdered form, has been processed into powder, right? So you get powdered, you get dried and powdered. You can get broccoli powder, you can get kale powder, you can get broccoli sprout powder. Does this take the place of chopping? I believe so, yeah, because it's been broken down in the process, yeah. And usually those are raw. Usually those are not cooked, so the myrcinase is intact and the chopping has happened. Wow, I don't see anybody else writing questions. You guys were quiet throughout. So if you have any questions or comments, you want to talk about how this applies to you, I'll take, you know, we have about 15 minutes left that we can do questions. So star 2 on your telephone keypad will raise your hand, or you can type it into the chat. Any questions or comments? And Lynn, if you have anything to add, anything that you think I missed or you want to point out or you want to clarify, please feel free to chime in. We have Lynn and Valerie. So Lynn, I'll let you go first.
Hey.
Okay. Hey.
I was fermenting them. I think you touched on it a little bit. I think that's another great way to really get the probiotic action in with those foods. So like, you know, your kimchi, your sauerkraut, all of that. I think that's another great way to increase that nutrition and digestibility of the food.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's a great way. And people think about, you know, sauerkraut, it's just cabbage, right? But you can make fermented vegetables of any kind. I've seen people do fermented cauliflower, just a jar of cauliflower that's been fermented. I've seen regular traditional looking sauerkraut where they're adding some of the others, you know, daikon or kale. And daikon's a really good one to be adding too because of its liver protective effects. And it's also, in Chinese medicine, it's used for decreasing mucus, right? It's supposed to be a mucus gobbler. So you can do a nice sauerkraut or fermented veggies with daikon in it, or just shred your daikon on your salad or within, you know, your vegetables and your sauces and your soups and even smoothies. So, yeah, but the fermented, you know, the only problem with fermented, there are some people, and it's a small number of people, guys, but a lot of press gets made about foods and these food constituents and sulfur and oxalates and histamines and all this stuff. And people get scared. You might feel that way where you just feel scared to eat anymore because you're afraid, you know, of all these little chemical constituents. And 20, 30, 40 years ago, before we had the internet, even 10 years ago, because it's just gotten really out there now, we didn't know about these constituents. We just happily ate these foods. And yeah, it's good to know if you do have a sensitivity and it might be something odd like that. But too many people are going around thinking they're sensitive to all these food constituents and they're afraid to eat. And this group of foods, this brassica family is such a powerhouse that I just don't want people to be scared to eat their brassicas.
Right. I completely agree. And that's why knowing this is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Right, Valerie. Hey.
Hi. I was thinking as you were presenting, at the point of talking about the impacts of the isothiocyanates binding to iodine, and I was thinking, okay, so we also know that chlorine, fluoride, and bromine compete for the receptors in the thyroid, and I'm thinking that's probably a larger impact on the thyroid than eating brassicas. Do you think that's true?
I totally think that's true. But you just said that, and I thought you were going to ask a different question, and I thought, hi, I don't know about that. I was wondering if they would also bind to the bromine and the chlorine, and that might be part of their protective effect.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think that's something we need to look into because that's a really great thing to think about. So yes, the bromine and the chlorine, and we're exposed to it all the time. Anybody who eats bread and various kinds of preservatives and goes in hot tubs and swimming pools and the chlorinated water, tap water that people are eating and showering with. So you may have, you know, a filter on your drinking water, but you're showering with this stuff, and these are competitive to iodine in the body. And I think that that's a much bigger problem in terms of iodine competition than is eating cruciferous vegetables. And so we just need to be eating a variety of foods, and for the most part, at least us in this Western part of the world, you know, not so much in Asia where they do eat more in the sea vegetables, we don't eat enough of that food, right? We don't eat sea vegetables as part of the standard American diet. Yeah, you go to a sushi restaurant, maybe. But nori's not actually the highest in iodine either. So that's why, I, get some kelp powder and sprinkle it on things. You don't want to overdo it. You don't want to be eating a pound of it a day. Little bits of it. It doesn't take much, and it's just a nice seasoning that gets lost in the wake of everything else. So, yeah, great point, and you got me thinking about this. So now I want to research whether it actually has that binding effect of binding out those guys.
I also have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
We also sometimes use the Lugol's iodine topically. Mm-hmm. Is it true that if we do that, that's not going to get too much iodine into our system, so that's a fairly safe way to apply iodine?
It's probably difficult to get too much through the skin. There's just so much the skin absorbs, and in fact, this is an old naturopathic test for iodine sufficiency. I don't know how valid it is that way. There's a lot of people who say yes and a lot of people who say no. But when you put it on your skin and you've gone enough, your skin stays that brownish color. But if you put the iodine on your skin and it gets absorbed in and the brownish color goes away really quickly, then it means that your body needed it. So when you start to see that your skin, you put it on your skin and it stays brown, that's your body not absorbing it. So I think there's a protective effect there, and I think that that is a good way to administer it. I'm just not sure about using it as a testing, because, you know, people say if you're tan, if you're black, if you're, you know, Asian, or, you know, different color skin than pure white, you may not notice it as much.
Right. Okay. I'm experimenting that with myself, and it's disappearing. I'm low in iodine.
Just keep applying it. Every time it disappears, you put more on.
Eat tons of brassica, so, you know, I think I'm in a good line there, but I just do want to make sure my iodine is good.
Yep, and you can always add the breath, the kelp to the stuff that you're eating.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. Great question. Now you got my curiosity piqued. All right, Mona. Hi, Mona.
Afternoon. Hey, so I have a question. I have a family member. She's a young lady that's just only 17, and she's done some really odd things these days. She's had some instances of some passing out, and they're not sure if she's had some seizures and just some weird things. And they've done a lot of tests on her and haven't really found anything. But as you were talking, because I'm already suspicious myself of thyroid issues with her, and as you were talking about the chlorinated water and stuff, they have a swimming pool. So, of course, she's swimming a lot. So I'm thinking, isn't there a test that we can actually do on her blood test-wise to check her iodine levels?
Yeah, absolutely. So here's the thing, and I also want to point this out. A lot of people, you know, they're scared of food. They're scared of, they're avoiding this and avoiding that. And a lot of people are saying, okay, I'm not going to swim anymore unless I have access to a spring-fed lake. And then what we're doing is throwing out these good habits because they have some little bit of negativity. And what we really need to do is figure out how can we support our bodies in excreting. So that's one thing. But in terms of testing, there's what's called the iodine load test. And it will test that you can do just the iodine. What I prefer is you do the pre and post iodine. So you basically take the iodine level, and then you go ahead and supplement with a 50 milligrams of iodine, and then collect the urine for 24 hours and then test it again. But you also want to get with that the halides test, because that'll test your fluorine, your bromine, and your chlorine, right? And so you see those are too high.
Okay, so say that again. Which other test?
So you basically, here's what you do. Go to Hakala Lab, H-A-K-A-L-A Lab. They offer to direct to public. If you're a health coach, you can usually set up an account with them so that you can, you know, get a little bit of a discount. So you basically go to Hakala. They have the iodine load test with the addition of the halides.
Okay.
H-A-L-I-D-E-S, right? And that'll give you all three of the halides. And then you can get that comprehensive test initially.
Okay.
Yeah, what I recommend, though, is that you do follow-up. So if you notice that the iodine's low, the halides are high, I mean, there's a very specific way that we read that test to see what's going on with the halides, then you want to go on a protocol for 3 months. Usually it's an iodine protocol plus some cleansing and sweating and things like that. And then you go back and do it again. When you go back and do it again, you don't necessarily have to do the complete test unless it showed that all the halides were high. So first time through, the halides looked good, or maybe just bromine was high. The second time, you just use bromine to save a little money. So.
Okay, and interestingly enough, she's not a very good eater, but she does like a lot of different salads and stuff of that nature. So she is eating a lot of, I think, probably cruciferous vegetables. So, I mean, I told them, I'm trying to get them to sit down and talk with me. And they were like, So I said, okay, so if they don't find anything, will you please sit down and talk with me? And my cousin was like, okay, yep, we'll do that. I was like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that, you know, I may be able to present her as a whole case, and because they've done a ton of lab testing already, so I mean, I'll have a ton of stuff to work with. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I hope they do, because people need to get that help, and most folks are not doing it. HakalaLab.com? Maybe it's HakalaLabs.com. That's not working.
Okay.
Yeah. So just do a Google search on Hakala, H-A-K-A-L-A Lab, and you'll find that.
All right, thank you very much.
Left the conversation. So let me see if I can find that correct link. She put up Hakala Lab. And I'll put it in the chat. HakalaLabs.com, L-A-B-S. That's the only stuff from home. Okay, good. I'll put it in the chat. There we go. Oh, Lynn, you came back. It said you left the conversation. How weird. There you go. All right. Thank you, Mona.
Thanks.
Any other questions? You guys feel good? Was this helpful? Was it useful? Was it too much detail and too geeky for you? When the body has more oxalate than it can break down, oxalate becomes stored over time in tissue and in thyroid. Right. That's for sure. And that causes, you can even get in the eyes where it can cause like a crystal formation. Kelly asked about what's a good spinach replacement for smoothies that taste good, and romaine, butter lettuce, green leafy lettuce. I personally like the bitter stuff, so I like dandelion and arugula and all, but it is bitter. You have to like bitter. But any of the lettuces, sprouts, parsley, cilantro, any of the herbs and stuff like that, basil, all of those things can work. What's raw versus cooked? Donna just said raw versus cooked, but I'm not sure. Oh, I'm a bit confused. I've heard that when there's a thyroid issue, eating raw spinach versus cooked spinach would hurt the thyroid. You must have come in late, because I explained all that in there. Right? Yeah, it has to do with the isothiocyanates and not breaking it down. So go back and listen to that again. And you can also go to my blog, where I have a very long detailed presentation of it and all the studies. Yeah, so you have to test for yourself, but yeah, we talked about that. Okay. Lynn. Yeah, Lynn. Hi.
Hi. I was just going to give you a frame of reference that Don had asked about that. So, and you actually have a really good article on isothiocyanates. And it's called When Eating Good Food Makes You Feel Bad. And it has to do, like you were talking about earlier, with the genetic polymorphisms and so forth. So I'll put that link in the chat as well. But that's why. Oh, she said she did hear that part. So, yeah.
Okay, so then maybe you need to rephrase your question, because if I'm missing your question, I'd like to answer it.
So basically what I think she's asking is, should she eat, can she eat cooked spinach versus raw?
Yeah, but you basically kill the sulforaphane content in it.
Right.
So, yeah. And spinach is high oxalate, but it's not.
And that's why I put what I put in there about it, because, you know, you do want to be careful with the oxalates, but there's more greens than just spinach. And
right, there's a lot of them. They're high in oxalate, but they're not high. They're not really a brassica. So, you usually can, but it doesn't completely break down. Oxalates don't get completely broken down by cooking. It just decreases. And in fact, the way that you want to cook oxalate, high oxalate foods is usually they say boil them and throw away the water because the oxalates will come out and be excreted in the water. But again, it's quantity, and you just have to find that sweet spot for you.
Exactly. You know, that's, I was telling somebody earlier today, you know, yes, there are oxalate foods and there's all these different labels we give foods, and it's good to know about them, but find out what works best for your body.
Mm-hmm.
And the best preparations for them. And, you know, that's what makes this fun in my weird mind and way of thinking. It's like, oh, look, what can we do with it?
Also, knowing this stuff allows you to figure out why a certain food might make you feel bad, and then what you need to be working on to correct it, and what you need to be minimizing until you get the underlying pathology corrected.
And then know that as you work on balancing your body, it will change. This is not a life sentence, generally. Mm-hmm. Again, it all depends. But as you do these things to bring yourself into balance, you can start including more brassicas and doing all those, the oxalates and things like that.
Yep, so. Absolutely. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for your questions and comments and intriguing inquiries, Valerie, to get me thinking about that. And I hope this was helpful for you. If you came in late or you want to watch this again, it should be up on the site within a few days. So thanks, everybody. I'm going to open up your line so you can say goodbye. Where are you? Open lines. All right. Bye-bye, everybody. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. You're welcome. Anytime.